Good evening. I'd like to welcome you all to the 2004 Jim Cash Writing Awards and Other Writing Awards Student Writers Night. This is my favorite event of the year because this represents the best part of university life. Not the Jim Cash Awards and the money, but the idea, the moment right now when we recognize the craft of student writers and identify them as experts and provide them with our undivided attention. And during a time when the liberal arts has to be taken into consideration in terms of budget cuts and how many people you can fit in a classroom, it's nice to still have intimate moments like this when we can celebrate what we're really here doing. On that note, I'm going to have Josh Landon come up and introduce our first reader.
I'm introducing Tim McCarty, who I believe is right in front of me. And I was hoping for something funny to say when I introduced him, or something like a clever anecdote or something like that. I couldn't think of anything, so I'll set up for something nice. Tim is basically the college student I dreamed of being when I was a kid. He's an extremely intelligent, very funny guy, and he's got the look that I think every college student dreams of having when they're in high school. And it's genuine too. Let's see. He commands a lot of respect. He's very smart. He works very hard. And by the way, he's taking over the job of fiction editor for the Red Cedar Review next year, which I can't think of a better person to do, because he attacks everything with a lot of passion, and he's very honest and very genuine. So without further ado, I introduce Tim McCarty, the James Brown of the English Department, reading a selection from his prize-winning story, Nebraska.
I wrote a long story, so I'll only be reading a little. If you want more, someday maybe it'll show up somewhere. It's Nebraska. I met Paul when we were 8 years old, and he publicly ratted me out for trying to cheat off of his spelling test. Paul had come to Grover Park Elementary only a month earlier. He rarely spoke to other students, but we knew he was smart, because Mrs. Carter was always giving him alternate assignments. Apparently at his old school, they had already learned cursive and long division. The combination of his reserve and intelligence is most likely what made him seem like such a perfect target. I was vexed as to the proper construction of the word magician, and attempted to sneak a little peek to my left, where he had correctly spelled the word in question. No sooner had I satisfied myself that I had copied it correctly, than Paul stood up from his seat, all 3 feet 9 inches of him, and declared to the whole of Mrs. Carter's third grade, "We have a cheater among us!" I failed the test, spent an hour with Principal Van Housen receiving a lecture on the virtues of honest scholarship, and was condemned to spend the next 4 spelling tests behind a personal cubby, which for the uninitiated is a trifold piece of cardboard roughly 2 feet high that is placed on a student's desk in order to prevent any view of the world outside one's own notebook. I vowed then and there, even before he had finished speaking, that I would make damn sure Paul Emerson never walked again. Fortunately, I did not cripple my classmate. Instead, that very afternoon at recess, I challenged Paul to a good old-fashioned schoolyard brawl. "Paul Emerson is a filthy rat. Paul Emerson is a donkey's butt. Paul Emerson picks his nose and eats it." I followed Paul all over the playground, shouting the most devastating insults I could muster, waiting for him to snap and submit to being beaten senseless. My merciless taunting drew quite a crowd, ranging from wide-eyed kindergartners who had yet to experience a real scuffle firsthand to wise old sixth graders hell-bent on watching two little kids tear at one another. "Paul Emerson farts in the bathtub and eats the bubbles." I was on a roll, but it did no good. Paul merely kept on slowly circling the playground, biding his time until the bell signified a return to the organized chaos that was third grade. I was losing my patience. I had to prove that I was no one to be messed with. If I let Paul get away without paying, I could expect to be the subject of unending torture from the other 27 mercenaries in Mrs. Carter's brigade. I would have to drop out of school and change my name. Twice. No, it had to be settled this way. "What are you, some kind of fraidy cat? Fraidy cat, fraidy cat, scared to death of the laundromat. Fraidy cat, fraid..." I only made it halfway through the second verse of my favorite taunting song before Paul wheeled around and shot me a look that by all accounts should have laid me out right there. "Would it make you feel better if we had a fight?" he deadpanned. It would have, actually. It made me feel much better. He'd figured it out right off the bat, but I wasn't about to give him the satisfaction. "Would it make you feel better if you went home crying to your mommy right now like the fraidy cat you are?" Some kids oohed at the viciousness of my retort. Paul just stood there stoically, looking unimpressed. "I guess that probably means yes, so let's get this over with." "Now that's more like it. Last man standing wins." I was pretty impressed with my own bravado. I crouched down slightly and tightened my fist, preparing myself for battle, when something completely unexpected happened. Paul sauntered up to me and punched me in the face. I fell to the ground and immediately began crying. I could feel my nose swelling up, and I tasted blood. The crowd scattered as fast as 50 children can. It was not supposed to happen like this. You didn't punch people in the face. That was against some sort of unwritten playground code of ethics. You were supposed to clumsily run at each other and wrestle on the ground till someone started crying or the recess lady got wise and broke you up. Punches in the face were reserved for primetime television and high school kids. Paul had apparently taken my posturing for the genuine sentiments of a sadistic child and not the baseless taunting of an embarrassed cheater. While I lay on the ground, Paul walked over to Mrs. Tisdall, who was waiting for the bell, and said, "I just hit Thomas and his nose is bleeding. We should probably both be sent home." And that is exactly what happened. At home, my mother stuck tissues up my nose, gave me a cup of hot chocolate and an ice pack, and went to the phone book to find Paul's number and make the obligatory call to his mother. It was then that the doorbell rang. My mother went to the door, and there stood Paul. "Hello, Mrs. Costello. My name is Paul Emerson. I am the boy responsible for your son's unfortunate injury. I have spoken to my mother, and we agreed that it is the right thing for me to do to come over and apologize. There is no excuse for the sort of barbarism I displayed in the playground today, and I hope that you and your son can forgive me for my reprehensible actions. Furthermore, you can expect my mother to pay a visit herself this evening after my father returns from work and can watch my younger brother. Though I should probably apologize to Thomas directly, I can be fairly certain that he is in a lot of pain, and I am the last person he would like to see. You can assure him that I will not fail to make an official and sincere apology at a later date when both of our tempers have cooled to a reasonable degree. Again, I apologize for my behavior and hope that you and your son will not take this afternoon's altercation as indicative of a lack of character on the part of myself or my mother, though I would not be so bold as to say the same of my father. Regardless, I am sorry. Thank you for your patience." And with that, he turned and walked back to his house. My mother stood nearly motionless. She closed the door and walked over to me in a bit of a daze. She hadn't gotten a word in, nor do I think she would have known what to say if afforded the opportunity. "What a strange little boy. Are you sure he's only 8? "Yeah, Mom, I'm sure." I sounded a bit silly thanks to the swelling and tissues in my nose. We sat silently for a few moments before she said anything else. "Tommy, do your friends call you Thomas?" "Nope, just that kid." "How about your teacher?" "She calls me Tommy." "Strange." "Yep." We drank hot chocolate and watched Bugs Bunny the rest of the afternoon. At about 7 o'clock, Mrs. Emerson came over and my mother sent me out of the room so that the adults could talk. Of course, I eavesdropped like any good 8-year-old. Most of the conversation involved niceties and boring adult talk, but I did learn that the Emersons lived right down the street, which wasn't at all odd because I figured Paul wasn't the kind of kid who played outside anyway. The most interesting part, however, was her attempt to explain her son's behavior, which was all I was really listening for in the first place. "Well, Donna," that was my mother, Donna, "I have to tell you that David and I are pretty confused, too. Paul has always been a serious child, and smart, but recently he's become downright strange. It happened about 6 months ago when we still lived in Hoboken. I was baking cookies for the school bake sale, and Paul kept eyeing the chocolate chip cookies. They're his favorites. He kept asking for one, and his father kept telling him no. David explained to Paul that they were for the bake sale, and that the long-term benefits of selling them would be greater than the immediate benefits of eating them. I didn't really care, but David is committed to teaching the children how to make rational decisions. Needless to say, Paul understood and stopped asking. Then, about an hour later, Paul and I were playing a game downstairs, and he went up to go to the bathroom. When he did, he caught his father sneaking a chocolate chip cookie. David said that he became so angry his whole face went red, but instead of saying anything, he just ran to the bookshelf, grabbed the dictionary, and locked himself in his room. I wanted to go in there and talk to him, but David said we should let Paul work out his anger for himself and talk to us when he was good and ready. So we waited. We waited for him to come out, and after a while, we had figured he had fallen asleep. Then, about 4 hours later, he burst out of the room, dictionary in hand, and said, "Dad, you are a hypocrite." Then he just turned around and went back into his room and went to bed. Things really haven't been the same around the house since then. He hasn't really spoken to his father, and his behavior just gets more and more strange. David and I hope it's a phase. My mother was obviously speechless again. I couldn't hear her, but I could feel the weight of the silence from down the hall. When she did say something, it didn't seem to help lighten the mood that much. Well, I guess that explains the vocabulary. And he hasn't eaten a chocolate chip cookie since then either. Children's tastes change? We really hope it's a phase. I went to bed after that. I didn't need any more information. If Mrs. Emerson's explanation wasn't enough, what happened the next day really solidified in my mind that Paul was not your average kid. I stayed home from school under the pretense of illness, but it was actually for embarrassment, and since my mother was so dumbfounded about the whole Paul situation, she didn't really seem to care. After a day of Cocoa Puffs, pajamas, and cartoons, I realized that it was 3:30 and the other kids would be getting out of school. Just as I had figured out how I was going to convince my mother that I was miraculously cured and should go out and play, the doorbell rang. I answered it and was more than a little surprised to see Paul standing there, just like the day before. He apologized for hitting me, but made it clear that he felt I was out of line in picking the fight, and that he still held fast to the belief that he had done the right thing for both of us by turning me in for cheating. He told me that though he did not believe me to be a bad person, he saw my cheating as reprehensible. I didn't know what reprehensible meant, but I listened anyway. Then he gave me my work for the day and offered to help me through the math assignment, which he said gave the whole class quite a bit of trouble. I can't exactly say what I thought about it at the time. Maybe I was just so confused that I gave in. Or maybe he was just that fascinating a character that I had to understand what he was all about. But I invited him in, and we've been best friends ever since.
My name's Kyle Figley. I pretend to be the business manager of the Red Cedar Review. And I'm up here to introduce Angela Sundstrom. And I'm trying to think of a way that I could really kind of, I don't know, think about and kind of explain a way in which my relationship with Angela has been. I've known Angela for a long time. We lived in the Royal Program in Abbott Hall freshman year. And when I learned that Angela had won the contest, I wasn't surprised at the fact that she had won it, because I had known that she had been writing poetry for a long time, but it just seemed that, I don't know, I've kind of been confounded ever since I've been at the university at what makes a good poet or good poetry. I can't figure it out myself. No matter how many times I've ever tried to write a poem, it's always been crap. And no matter how many classes I've ever been where I've had to study a poem or a poet or anything like that, you know, I'm given the poetry and I'm given kind of, oh, here's some of the things we're talking about. And I can kind of BS my way through and, you know, put something down enough on a paper where a professor will look at it and say, okay, he knows what he's supposed to be saying about this, and so everything's just kind of move on. But when I'm approached with something like Angela's work, it's just amazing to me, because I think to really have a poem kind of come across to the reader, it needs to be eloquent, and it also needs to have, you know, some kind of a sense where even as eloquent or as well drawn out or as thick and great as language can be, it still needs to talk to you in a certain way. And I get the same sense when I talk to Angela as a person and when I have class with her, when I see her on the street, that she has a way of connecting with people and she can be real excitable and she can be extremely funny. And then when I read the poem, I don't get the same immediate kind of sense, but underneath there is, you know, a lot of emotion and feeling that I don't think I can ever be able to convey to somebody else in writing or in language or in anything. And so I think, you know, part of knowing who she is and part of seeing her work kind of show how amazing a student and a person she's been. And so come on up and read, Angela.
Thank you very much, Kyle. I think I'm going to read 3 selections for you this evening. I'll finish with the one that won the contest. I'm going to start. This one's called Men. That man is a philosopher, I say, his beard astray like the tomes of Nabokov fermenting in the dust on my floor. His eyes are like crow droppings in winter. You are a mystic fool, always packing your cigarettes as if one more drag can save you, he replies. I shall save myself with erasers and eyes peeled back like fresh oranges, spotting genius on the streets of Grand River, mostly in the sinuous lines and angles of bums with long beards and backpacks stuffed with cans. I fear men who think and talk to me as philosophers, but relish the ones who walk by the picture window, turning the corner like a poem outskirting my mind. This one is called White. Your back arches against the bark, white as the noise of spring. Your feet become the Dharma roots that travel into the blank earth. Your belly stretches into dirt. I have scooped miles of soil in search of your core. white, like the pallor of time, the essence of clax, the supine lily circling my head. I have tried to uproot the minutes, seconds, hours between us, but they are too deep in the white. I watch you subside into the ground, yet no one hears me, but the lilies, white in their deaf gaze. And this is the poem for the contest. It's called Montreal Massacre. And I'm going to preface it. In the late 1990s, a man walked into a Canadian university and subsequently shot 9 women simply because they were women in the engineering program, which he considered to be a male-dominated field. Montreal Massacre. Caught in the rhythms of morning, silent and thoughtless like prayer, he loaded the gun, systematically as brushing teeth, each bullet a girl, rolling off his tongue like a hymn as he planned the final swallowing. At 9, he shaved, saw their pale faces like lotuses floating on the head of his razor. At noon, he pressed bread and meat into his mouth with fingers methodical and slow, like those feeding honey and milk to gods on temple evenings. He walked down the corridor. The ceremony began as he entered the classroom, clearing it with the reverence of his gun, sweeping their bodies against the floor, 9 women before him, like red carnations at the feet of Shiva.
I just want to apologize for before when I was up here because I didn't introduce myself. I'm Laura Tisdall, the general editor of Red Cedar Review, and I didn't introduce myself because I was all excited that I wrote something down because I got here an hour early because I read my clock wrong. And I've never done that before, like written before I spoke out loud. So I was very excited to have something planned. And I was so excited that I didn't introduce myself. Now I'm up here to introduce Dan Rosine, who won the George B. Lawson Award for a literary essay this year. I've known Dan for 4 years, and I've worked with him on Red Cedar Review, and for me, this essay represents a real achievement in Dan's life, an achievement for his friends and for the writers that he's worked with. I was trying to think about what I would say about his essay, and the word that kept coming back to me was that it's a body, and it's called Hunchback, so it's about a body that's the subject of the writing, but it also represents a body of commitment and a complete body of work. I was in Dan's beginning nonfiction writing class when he started this essay, and I watched him struggle through his revisions, and not just the revisions of the work, but dealing with the idea of writing a personal essay and sort of making yourself vulnerable to the reader by pointedly writing about yourself and your family in such a naked way. And also, it's a body of commitment, because Dan's not really an English major. He's a computer engineering major, and he also is a mentor in Brody Hall, and he also was an intern at the MSU Press, and he also worked for the Red Cedar Review for 4 years. And so I've watched him struggle with what writing means to him, and he's had to evaluate over and over and over again the time that he's put into it. And I think that this recognition is especially important for Dan because it proves to him what all of us have been saying all along, that for him it's a worthwhile commitment to be writing, which I'm going to let him prove by reading his beautiful essay.
First of all, this is the first time I've had the chance to be up here and speak on my own behalf, and since I'm out of here in 2 weeks, I hope you'll indulge me as I have a few thank yous. First of all, I want to say that I'm very honored to win in this category, because being in creative essay classes the last 2 semesters, I know there's tons of really, really great writers in that field here on campus. And I actually thought about maybe trying to pass mine off as fiction, because I thought maybe there'd be too much competition. As Laura said, I've really struggled in my development as a writer, so this is very meaningful to me, as Laura described. I'd like to thank Marcia Aldrich for her dedication to students and being willing to be involved with so many different creative writing projects that students have been working on. And she often doesn't get a lot of credit for that financially, and for one, despite the fact that we're paying MSU money for the credits. I also want to thank her because she's probably not going to like this term, but she's been kind of my literary mother, nagging me and encouraging me as necessary and putting up with all my bad habits. So, and I'd also like to thank the literary community of Red Cedar Review. This story that I'm about to read was began as an assignment in Marcia's class where we had to write about part of our body. My mother instructs me to take off my shirt, bend over, and reach my hands toward the floor. She comes up behind me and runs her fingers along my spine, creating a tingling sensation. She stares at my naked back, calculating the curvature of my spine. Drawing her hand from my back to her lips, she lets out a sigh. "I can put my shirt back on," she tells me. My mother is a nurse and diagnoses problems before our doctors, such as her scleroderma. I am now sitting in my underwear in a room at the family doctor's office. I'm supposed to be sitting at a desk reading Kafka in Mrs. DeYoung's seventh grade English class, but my mother has brought me here to test a hunch. The men on my father's side of the family have had a history of back problems, and I have grown too quickly. I have a crooked spine. I'm gawky, about 5'10 and 120 pounds. Ashamed of my rail-thin body, I hate to take even my shirt off in front of people. Sometimes when teased in the school locker room at basketball practice, to make light of things, I tell classmates that I'm doing my impression of an albino minute bull on a fast. At the doctor's office, I'm not in the mood for black humor. My bodily abnormality seems on display as Dr. Brayman looks me over. Examining me, he nods towards my mother and recommends that I undergo further testing. The tests will hopefully confirm his opinion that surgery can be avoided if I wear a corrective brace. He calls the hospital and verifies appointment times with my mother. She is concerned about how much school I will miss. I am not. I'm the class brain, read class nerd, and I know I will catch up. On the car ride back to school, she asks me how I feel about what the doctor said. If I have to wear a brace, then I guess that's what needs to be done. I have nothing to lose. I'm already considered a geek. Wearing a brace would make it official. Nearing school, I slouch in the passenger seat. As if forgetting where we'd just been, my mother lectures me, "Sit up straight, that's bad for your posture." Without thinking, she slips into a routine of nagging me into compliance. "If you keep slouching like that, you'll turn into a hunchback. How are you going to get girls to like you then?" Perhaps a supportive mother-in-law would be some encouragement, I think to myself. I am in a room at the big hospital in the city. A nurse hands me a hospital gown and pants and tells me to put them on. The fabric smells of old people. I strip down to my underwear and step into the pants. The pant legs only reach about mid-calf, while I can hardly tighten the drawstrings enough to keep them around my narrow waist. I'm reminded of my awkwardness. I take the shirt and slip my arms into the sleeves. Looking for buttons, I find only tie strings. I tie them all in butterfly-shaped knots. A stripe of skin showing from my neck to my knees, I feel exposed and I do not want to come out. After some time, a nurse knocks, wondering why I am taking so long. I let her in. She suppresses laughter and tells me to tie the strings in the back. Left alone again, I struggle to retie the knots behind my back. Embarrassed, I emerge and am taken to a room down the hall. I'm told to stand in profile, my folded arms upraised. The lead triangle they place in front of my pelvis to shield my genitals from exposure to radiation only makes me feel more exposed. Several months later, I return to the hospital. I have not seen any doctors since my last visit. I am told to put on a hospital gown again, and do so quickly this time. When I come out, I am led to a huge hollow cylinder that I have been told is a giant magnet. Some nurses help me onto a long, protruding tray that I must lie down on. I slide it into the center of the silky white machine. The MRI machine, which I'd been told would resemble a big metal donut, instead reminds me of the incinerators that I'd seen in history class films, or perhaps a mortuary bed. Yet I'm more fascinated by it than afraid. Inside the Yannick enclosure, I lay perfectly still for an hour. They've allowed me to listen to music, to listen to a radio station to occupy my mind and block out the noise. I hear the dead voices of John Lennon and Jim Morrison float over the jackhammering sound of the chrysalid machine. The drumming of Ringo and John Densmore has been replaced by its thumping pulse. My mind wanders listening to this mechanical heartbeat, synchronizing with my own. I feel secure, peacefully quiescent, in its ethereal, amniotic ambience. It is a meditative experience, restorative. A few weeks later, I'm wearing only my underwear again. I'm standing in the office of another doctor, a doctor of orthotics. My arm's lifted, he takes my measurements carefully. He wraps his measuring tape around me like a tailor, measuring the circumference of my chest, my stomach, my waist, my buttocks. He consults the x-rays, sketching angles in pencil and taking notes on a sheet of paper. My deformity has been calculated in degrees, my misshapenness quantified. Months pass and I stand in his office once more. This time I am wearing underwear and an undershirt as I try on my new back brace for the first time. It is confining. I can bend forward at the waist somewhat, but I cannot arch my back or bend to the side. The brace covers nearly all of my torso, except an area to enable my lungs to expand. The cushioned plastic mold extends as far south possible without obstructing the bending of my legs at the hip, without putting too much pressure on my bladder when I sit up. In the back, the brace reaches my shoulder blades and covers a third of my butt, the plastic sometimes touching the seat I sit on. Pencil diameter holes in the front permit the brace to air out and keep from stinking. Two Velcro straps attached in the back will hold the brace on me for the next 2.5 years. Even while sleeping, I will have to wear the brace. I am told I am allowed to take the brace off for 2 hours each day to perform corrective exercises, which I seldom do, my only resistance to the treatment. The brace is designed to correct my scoliosis and kyphosis. My spine bows to the left in my upper back and forms an S-shaped curve in profile. My first day wearing the brace at school, I have fun with it. Without informing anyone I am wearing the brace, I tell a classmate who picks on me that I've been working out, doing a lot of sit-ups to improve my abs, and invite him to test my progress. I ask him to hit me in the stomach as hard as he can. His conscience deters him, so I have to coax him a little. But I'm persistent, and eventually he winds up and socks me good, leaving his hand sore for a week. Wearing a back brace provides me some advantages. My waistline has increased 4 inches overnight, requiring a new wardrobe. I feel less skinny. When I look in the mirror, my pectoral region no longer looks pathetic. I have a more solid trunk. Ironically, I feel more attractive to girls. With or without the brace, I am a nerd, but the brace hides my skinniness. Dubbed the Boston Mold, the manufacturer's name printed on the brace, and a nickname by which I am sometimes called. The brace provides amusement. What other kid can fool you into thinking he has a pencil jabbed into his stomach? Who else can use their torso as a drum pad, breaking the silence in Mr. Haverding's boring science classes? I grow accustomed to the brace quickly. 3 years of dental braces have acclimated me to having my physical imperfections corrected, molded into a more proper shape. Over time, my back brace begins to seem like another part of my body. It gives me a sense of security, like a turtle in a shell, a sense of tranquility, like a caterpillar in a cocoon. I feel naked during the 2 hours a day I shed my plastic exoskeleton. I sit hunched in front of a computer, typing a report comparing Ovid's account of the Adonis myth with Norse parallels. The walls of my dorm room are empty except for a print of Dali's Ascension, partly occluded by my monitor. In the painting, a cylindrical double image of a sunflower is foregrounded by a horizontal Christ, feet facing out. His suspended body appears to move both into the beige orb and ascend toward the tear-stained face of Mary overhead. cast in the image of Gawa, Dali's wife and muse. The chair I'm sitting on in my dorm room is uncomfortable, not designed for someone my height. I've been without the brace since ninth grade when my back stopped growing. My legs continued to grow another couple inches, pushing me to a height of 6'5". My scoliosis is now mild, no more than any other healthy person. The kyphosis, the hunching of my upper back and shoulders, had been largely corrected by the brace, but has been worsening since abandoning the plastic shell. Perhaps exercise or another brace could counteract the regression of my spinal curvature, but I suspect it is inevitable, and I will do nothing to resist it. My studies and career aspirations in writing and computer science sentenced me to a life spent hunched in front of a computer screen, whether composing prose or code. My fiance knocks on the door. I embrace her, her 5'2" frame not quite coming up to my armpits. She has always been attracted to my tall, thin build. When we started dating, she was the first to admit her attraction, initiating our relationship. I am the antithesis, the exorcism of her father, a short, stocky man who paid more attention to his farm work than their strained relationship. She wraps her arms around me and reaches underneath my shirt, feeling the bare skin of my back. Enveloped in her embrace, I am vulnerable, but safe. Naked, but sheltered. I hunch forward to kiss her.
My name is Colleen, and I am currently the poetry editor of the Red Cedar Review. I'm really not a big fan of talking in front of large crowds of people, but I was so excited to learn that I was going to get to introduce Veronica tonight, so I thought I would get over it. So I haven't known Veronica very long. This semester has been the first time I've really gotten to get to know her and get to know her work a little bit. We had a poetry class together, and even though I haven't gotten a chance to read her prose, from what I've seen of her poetry, she's definitely a very talented writer. Her poetry is always very thoughtful, just very creative and surprising in a good way. Tonight, she's going to read her piece, which won first place for the Jim Cash Prize for Fiction. It's entitled What Safe Means, and I don't want to say too much about it, but it's about a 15-year-old girl and her brother who are having a birthday party. One of the guests is an older friend who may or may not be a prostitute. Veronica.
I think the only thing you need to know about this, since I'm skipping around a little bit, is that I'm just reading an excerpt, and the postcard that the narrator is going to reference is the only contact her brother has had with the prostitute since she moved away. The spring my brother got the postcard, she was living in Portland in a house full of punks. She didn't have any money. She asked him to visit her, to bring whatever he had, and said that no one would mind. In fact, everyone would like it fine. But he didn't go. He didn't even write her back because she had left him no return address. The front of the card was a glossy photograph of two old people holding hands on a tiny street in front of a place called Sally's. They had these wide, cheesy expressions, like nothing could possibly be better than standing around on the crooked streets of Portland. But she wasn't really happy there. Sometimes she didn't eat because the hippie restaurants she stole from were closed down. She would stay awake long after her boyfriend had passed out, stay awake and walk around on the roof until it got too cold and she had to walk around inside. How do I know these things? My brother might as well have told me. He kept the postcard against the back of his underwear drawer, next to a small hand towel and a jar of Vaseline. This is how I know he didn't forget, though I bet he would have remembered either way, with or without her handwriting to remind him. Anyway, this girl who left school and home and all of us behind, she got pretty desperate for cash. And I don't know who found out first, probably one of those guys who graduated a couple years ago, but still hang around, bringing kegs to our parties and offering freshmen their first after-school cigarette. One of them saw her working in a different town, Not Portland, because she didn't want her boyfriend to know, but somewhere sort of close by, I guess. Or maybe one of them actually had sex with her. One way or another, everyone found out she was a total prostitute, like for a living, and it was big talk in school for about a week. My brother acted like it wasn't happening, but he got pretty pissed when some sophomore asked him if he ever did her back when they were friends. I've never seen him so mad. He grabbed the kid by his collar and dragged him into the boys' bathroom, where I hear he slammed him against a stall door and almost hit him in the face, but stopped when he saw that the kid was crying. Later that night, he wouldn't come out of his room. I imagine he was just looking at her postcard or something. Maybe crying, too. I mean, neither of us is much of a crier, but everyone has their moments. Now this same prostitute was coming to sleep in my house. What if she has a disease? I asked my brother. He was in his bedroom, flipping through channels on TV half an hour before people were supposed to show up. His eyes didn't move from the screen. Don't be a bitch. It's my birthday. Your birthday is next week, and anyway, I'm just saying, you've never met a prostitute, you don't know, I said. I stood in the doorway. His room was a mess. Neither of you, and I've known her for years, you even met her once. I cleared my throat and looked at the back of his head. She's not the same girl you thought you knew or whatever. You don't even hear what people say, the things she's done for like $5. She's a whore. She's not your girlfriend, you know. Do you, like, love her or something? I said. My brother grimaced and rolled his eyes. He turned to toss a magazine at my stomach. Spin. Why are you bugging me right now? Did I do something to you? Come on, get out. Go. I didn't move, so he groaned and got up and put his hand on the door. It was much bigger than mine. His face got softer then, like he suddenly remembered that we're family. This is fast forward to the party. I wandered around the basement with my glass of water until I found some of my brother's girlfriends who I kind of knew from football games and stuff. They were high, with their arms all entwined, laughing with huge pink mouths, but they managed to recognize me even in the dark. The lights were off, of course, though someone had brought a box of Christmas lights and they lay in the corner, glowing, barely. I went on to the guest room, locked. I could just imagine what was going on in there. What was going on in there? Staring, I wondered if the prostitute had arrived when I was in my room. I pressed my ear against the door. She could be in there, lying on one of Grandma's quilts with some greasy, smelly high school guy, even one of the graduates who were busy milling around with hungry, darting looks. Glancing left, I saw a thin yellow line under the bathroom door. I felt my way along the wall until my hand found the cold metal knob. It gave easily, and I peered inside, squinting, expecting bright light, but facing about 5 blank-faced kids and some big blue candles that I'd never seen before. They all looked about my age, but the only one I recognized was my brother, until I saw the face of the girl, whose feet he was slouched against. She looked at my face and smiled. Her shorts wore more phone numbers than words. So this is the sister. We meet again, sis. She grinned at me with a lot of teeth. My brother looked up at her, but she kept her eyes on me. Yeah, come in, what's up? He said, motioning. Are mom and dad cool? Smell anything? Hurry up. I stepped onto the towel that was spread against the floor. 2 skinny girls with short hair slipped back out through the door behind me. I was alone with my brother and the prostitute, Christ. There was a silence, and I realized how quiet the bathroom is without the humming of the overhead light. You met her once, remember? My brother offered. He was trying too hard. Who was this girl that he loved so hard, so willingly? She had knobby knees and wore unlaced biker boots, no socks. I imagined her knees pressed against her chest, her boots bobbing in the air on either side.
I'd like to thank you all for coming tonight and to sort of announce that next Thursday there's going to be a poetry slam that the Offbeat and the Red Cedar Review are hosting, and it's going to be in the field right behind student services. And if you want to sign up to slam, email Kristen at offbeat@msu.edu or else just show up. It's at 6:00. And thanks for coming tonight.